The views expressed on the following broadcasts do not necessarily reflect those of KHLT, Take 12 Radio, or our affiliates. The opinions on this show should not be considered as medical, psychological, or professional advice and are those of the host, co-host, and guest. Take 12 Radio and KHLT Recovery Broadcasting are not affiliated with any particular 12-step fellowship.
One day at a time with its failures and fears. Portion of pain and burden of care, we must meet.
Welcome to Walking Through the Language of the Heart, a journey into the grapevine writings of Alcoholics Anonymous co-founder Bill W. And now, here are your co-hosts, Chris S. and the Monty Man.
That's right. Welcome, family, to another episode, episode 15 of Walking Through the Language of the Heart. For those of you who have never joined us before, we're going through the book, The Language of the Heart. These are Bill W.'s writings in the grapevine from 1944 to 1970. And co-hosting this show with me is our good friend, Chris S. Welcome aboard, Chris, to this week's show.
Great to be here, Monty. Great to be here.
So what are we talking about this week in this book?
You know, we're going to be talking about money.
Yeah.
It's probably the second time he brings this subject up, right?
Yeah.
We had a show earlier where it was on finances, but I can't wait to hear what he has to say this time. But each one of these articles is like a snapshot into the evolution the way Alcoholics Anonymous grew and became what we've experienced over the last number of years. And going back to these foundational writings is really, really interesting. So I'm looking forward to it. This is titled "Lack of Money Proved AA Boon." You know, not the best syntax in the world. I would have said lack of money proves a boon to AA, maybe.
Right.
But anyway, I'm not going to criticize. You know me. But this was written in June 1947. So that's really interesting. I say we get right to it. What do you say?
All right, let's jump in.
All right. So June 1947, lack of money proved AA boon. Thousands of newer AAs inquire, just what is the Alcoholic Foundation and what is its place in AA? Who set it up? Why do we send it funds? Most members, because their groups are in frequent contact with our headquarters in New York, understand that place to be a sort of general service to all AA. And that's what it became. That's what it ended up being named. They called it the Alcoholic Foundation. It became general service.
Mm.
Reading the AA Grapevine each month, they know the Grapevine to be our principal monthly journal. But the history of the Alcoholic Foundation and its relation to these vital functions and to AA as a whole, they scarcely understand at all. Now, for a bit of history. During its first years, Alcoholics Anonymous didn't even have that name. This is the first time I've seen him say this.
Wow.
Nowhere in the big book, nowhere in the normal literature does it say that Alcoholics Anonymous got its name from the book when the book was published.
Right.
You know, we know that from some of the first 100, but this is the first time he's saying it. Alcoholics, nameless indeed, we consisted by late 1937 of but three small clusters of alcoholics. Akron, Ohio, the first group, New York City, the second group, and a few members at Cleveland, our third group to be. There were, I should guess, about 50 members in all three cities. The very early pioneering period had passed. Dr. Bob and I, having first met in Akron in the spring of 1935, we were becoming sure we had something for those other thousands of alcoholics who didn't yet know any answer. How were we to let them know just how could the good news be spread? That was the burning question. Much discussion in a little meeting called by Dr. Bob and me at Akron in the fall of 1937 developed a plan. This plan later proved to be approximately one-third right and about two-thirds wrong. Familiar process of trial and error. Because the development of the first groups had been such a slow, hard process, we then supposed that none but seasoned pioneers could start new ones. Though we had misgivings, it seemed inevitable that about 20 of our solid members would have to lay aside their personal affairs and go to other cities to create new centers. Much as we disliked the idea, it appeared as if we must take on, temporarily at least, a squad of AA missionaries. Plainly, too, these missionaries and their families would have to eat. That would take money, quite a lot of it, we thought. You know, this goes deeper into the history of what we've heard about mm-hmm. for many years, Monty. Even when Bill tells his story, he touches on this. You know, we were going to have missionaries. We were going to have hospitals. We were going to write a book. We were going to get tons of money from the Rockefellers. You know, we were going to, you know, people were going to wheelbarrow money in
yeah.
when we tell them what we're doing. But this is really getting deep into it. He's basically saying that they wanted the missionaries because they believed experienced AAs were the people who needed to start the groups. You couldn't just let a newcomer start a group or send a book somewhere and have somebody read it and start a group. but a lot of times, you know, this is what happened. It happened sure. slowly, though. This is really the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. It happened slowly. Seasoned AA members would move around because of their job or whatever, and they would start AA groups. And that's the way a lot of the first groups started. And once a group started in an area, you know, people would come from far and wide to that group, and then people would go back to wide and far and start their own groups. So that's kind of what happened. But he thought he'd have to pay these people. You know, you can't work and do this, Monty. You know, we want you full time starting AA meeting.
Right, I love
so,
it.
he got that a little wrong. But that was not all. It was felt we needed AA hospitals at Akron and New York. These places being regarded as our twin meccas. There, excellent medical care. And high-powered spirituality, Monty. We were sure be sprayed on drunks who would flock from all corners of the nation once the magic word cure got around. Even as many newer AAs still have such fancies, we old-timers did dream these very dreams. Providentially, neither the AA hospital nor our wholesale missionary dreams came true. Had these then materialized, AA surely would have been ruined. We would have gone professional on the spot. And, you know, one of the things that is magical about Alcoholics Anonymous, Monty, is it's not professional.
Yeah.
I think that's one of its greatest assets. You know what I mean? Nobody's in charge. There's no dues. There's no rule book. It is an organic expression of God's consciousness, I believe, Alcoholics Anonymous, and it speaks through the AA members, this God consciousness. And if it would have been made professional, I don't know if it would have lasted. Because it's for fun and for free, and it starts in church basements, and you know, any two people with a book in their hand can start a meeting. Because of all that, I think it's going to survive. I think there's going to be Alcoholics Anonymous for centuries to come. But if we would have wrapped it around a business organizational structure, wherein all the members had to participate in that business structure with specific dues and specific responsibilities and stuff. I'm not sure it would have made it. You know, that's just my personal opinion.
Do you find that people are still, for lack of a better term, outsiders are still amazed at the structure of Alcoholics Anonymous and that it works at all?
You know, a lot of times, they are amazed, and a lot of times they don't say, "Hey, that's great." A lot of times they say, "What?" You know, and don't give it really the respect that it deserves. Mm. You know, there's just a lot of people out there who have are professional addiction, you know, treatment professionals or whatever, yeah, who don't have a real high regard of AA. I'll give you one example. All right. Now, this guy, I'm going to tell you this story because I think it's pertinent. This guy was an addiction psychiatrist who was all over social media. This is about 10 years ago, right? I mean, he's commenting on this and he's putting this article out. He's putting that article out. And I commented on one of his things and we went back and forth. I don't do this anymore because I've quit fighting alcohol or anything else, Monty. So I don't engage in back and forth on social media. Right. But back then I did. And I was basically telling him he didn't know what the hell he was talking about. And he came back to me with this. He said, "Chris, you need to understand that the success rate for Alcoholics Anonymous, it wraps somewhere around 6% of the people that get sent to Alcoholics Anonymous from treatment find it beneficial. 6%. He goes, "I could get that with a placebo." And that's what he wrote back as a response to me. Right? This is a psychiatrist. And I freaked out, right? This is how I went back at him. I said, "Well, let me ask you some questions." I said, let me ask you this. Let's say you're a medical doctor, right? Let's say you come up with a cure for pancreatic cancer. And you know this is the cure for pancreatic cancer. And you start a clinical trial with 100 people. And 100 people with severe pancreatic cancer come. And you have an operation that you perform, in surgery. And that operation, you're absolutely sure, is going to cure these people of pancreatic cancer. Let's just assume that for a minute. Okay, 100 people show up to the hospital and 90 of them congregate in the waiting room. And some of them become the coffee maker at the waiting room. And some of them start little organizations and support stuff. And somebody's in charge of information and somebody's in charge of literature. And there's even sponsors in that support group in the waiting room, but only 10 people go in for the operation. Would you say that you're only 10% effective with your cure? And he goes, "No, because only 10 people came in and got the cure and they were cured." So I go, "You don't count the people in the waiting room." And he goes, "No." I go, "Well, you're counting the people in our waiting room."
Yeah.
the meetings are the waiting room.
Yeah.
In Alcoholics Anonymous. Wow. You send people to the waiting room. Have they gone in for the soul surgery of the 12 steps? Have they paid the money back? Do they pray and meditate every day? Have they gone out and made amends? Do they do moral inventory? Do they continue to practice the principles on a daily basis? Do they help other alcoholics go through the steps? If your 6% success rate counts all the people in the waiting room, then I gotta tell you, I'm not buying your statistics.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of how I went back at this guy, and I never heard from him again. I basically told him, you're looking at this the wrong way. The recovery program is the 12 steps. It's not the meetings. So it, just like your pancreatic cancer recovery is the surgery, it's not the waiting room.
Yeah, that's good.
You understand what I mean, Mike?
Yeah, that's excellent. That's excellent.
So I went off on a tangent there.
No, I love it. That's great.
You know I do that. Okay. It says here, then there was still a third dream that was to prepare a book of experience. The one we know today is Alcoholics Anonymous. We were sure that unless our recovery experience were put on paper, our principles and practices would soon be distorted. We might be ridiculed in the press. Besides, did we not owe at least a book to those alcoholics who couldn't get to our hospitals or who, perchance, weren't reached right away by our advancing missionaries? As everyone knows, the AA book dream did come true. The other dreams didn't.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't practical for alcoholics to run hospitals. We're not good at all getting together and starting businesses. If a whole bunch of alcoholics from an AA meeting get together and start a business, goodbye business. They had to learn that the hard way.
Right.
And paid missionaries, who's going to manage them? Who's going to give them the curriculum? Who's going to pay all their expenses? It was pie in the sky. But Bill had control over the book. Bill could write the book. And he was a very intelligent, lettered man. He'd gone to all kinds of college. So he wrote the book. He was able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But it surely looked in 1937 as though we must have considerable money. Perhaps it was because I lived at New York, where there is supposed to be lots of it, that I was delegated to set about raising funds so our nameless movement might have its field workers, hospitals, and books. All right, Bill, you think we need all this money? You're in charge. Have you ever seen that happen in a meeting? We need cookies and we need decaf and okay.
Right.
You're in charge.
You go get it.
How simple it appeared. Did we not already have in prideful imagination the beginning of one of the greatest social, medical, and spiritual developments of all time? Weren't we drunks all salesmen? Hadn't I been a Wall Street man? How easy to raise money for such a cause as ours. And he really believed that. And Monty, I have fallen prey to this in a number of different ways, with some of the organizations I was a part of. The show Afflicted and Affected, how could people not, contribute to something that's really beneficial, mm-hmm. especially to alcoholics? Well, it just doesn't happen. Bill writes in the 12 and 12 that alcoholics are tighter than the bark on a tree when they get sober. and that's pretty much been my experience. You can't fund addiction treatment with donations. People will give to children's cancer and people will give to the Tourette's Syndrome Society, but they're not going to give to alcoholics. It's just not. And even the people who want to give to alcoholics, a lot of times they're steered away from it because it'll give the organization a bad name. I've known people who've donated money to certain causes that have to do with alcoholics who said it needs to be anonymous.
Yeah.
I'll donate this money, but it needs to be an anonymous donation. I don't want my name associated with you guys. So anyway, I've learned a few of these crazy lessons myself, but Bill was going to really learn it. He was going to go back to Manhattan. He was going to knock on the Rockefeller's door. He was going to do everything he could possibly do. He was going to put fraudulent stock certificates together. He was going to do whatever he needed to do to try to raise money. And I think what this article is getting at is it's a good thing he didn't. Because this stayed a work of goodwill. It stayed a work of goodwill. All right. The awakening from that money dream was rude. it soon appeared that people with money had little interest in drugs. As for our grandiose scheme of banding alcoholics together in squads, platoons, and regiments, well, that was plainly fantastic, wasn't it? Drunks, people said, were difficult enough one at a time. Why present each American community with an organized regiment of them? I love that. Hadn't the donors better put their money into something constructive?
Right.
Like tuberculosis or cancer? Or why shouldn't they invest in the prevention of alcoholism? One more attempt to salvage hopeless drunks couldn't possibly succeed. Such were the answers to our plea for money.
Mm.
Then one day, in the midst of discouragement, something momentous happened. It was another of those critical turning points in AA, of which we have seen so many that no one can call them coincidence. At the office of my physician brother-in-law, I was bemoaning in typical alcoholic fashion how little we poor drunks were appreciated, especially by people of means. I was telling my relative for the 10th time how we had to have money soon or else. Listening patiently, he suddenly said, "I've got an idea. I used to know a man by the name of Dick Richardson. He was somehow connected with the Rockefellers, but that was years ago. I wonder if he's still there. Let me call him up and find out." On what little events our destinies sometimes turn, how could either of us know that a simple phone message was to open a new era in AA, that it was to inaugurate the Alcoholic Foundation, the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and our general service office? I've really got to be honest with you. He's overestimating the impact of the Rockefellers here.
Yeah.
You know, and he may be doing it, you know, because the Rockefeller name, you know, all you need to do is say Rockefeller and people open their eyes real wide. But I don't see that the Rockefellers were responsible for all this stuff. But let's see what he comes up with here. 2 days after my brother-in-law's call, we sat in the Rockefeller offices talking to Willard Dick Richardson, the most lovable of men. Dick was the first of that early series of non-alcoholic laymen who saw us through when the going was very hard, and without whose wisdom and devotion the Alcoholics Anonymous movement might never have been. When he had heard the story, our new friend showed instant understanding. He immediately translated understanding into action. He suggested that some of our alcoholic brotherhood meet with several of his own friends and himself. Shortly afterward, on a winter evening in 1937, this meeting took place at Rockefeller Center. Present were Dick Richardson, A. Leroy Chipman, also known as Chip, Albert Scott, Frank Amos, and my brother-in-law, Leonard Strong. Dr. Bob and Paul S. came down from Akron. The New York ex-toppers numbered half a dozen, and we were accompanied by Dr. William D. Silkworth, who, as the first physician ever to champion our cause, had already given us measureless help and encouragement. Of course, we alcoholics were delighted. Our money troubles we thought were over. If money was the answer, we had surely come to the right place.
Mm.
So he started to get meetings going with the Rockefellers. Now, you know, this was a charitable arm of, you know, the Rockefeller organization. And it's the job of charitable arms to listen to people and, you know, to vet out, you know, different causes and different charities. And that's kind of what was happening here. Let's see what all these guys are about. Following introductions, each alcoholic told his own personal story, these accounts being enthusiastically confirmed by our ardent friend, Dr. Silkworth. After which, with becoming reluctance, we brought up the subject of money. As our hearers had seemed much impressed by our recovery stories, we made bold to expand on the urgent need for hospitals, field workers, and a book. We also made it clear that this would take money. Quite a lot. Then came one more turn in AA destiny. The chairman of the meeting, Albert Scott, now deceased, a man of large affairs and profoundly spiritual in his nature, said in substance, "I am deeply moved by what I have heard. I can see that your work thus far has been one of great goodwill, one alcoholic personally helping another for the love of the thing. That is the first century Christianity in a beautiful form. But aren't you afraid that the introduction of hospitals and paid field workers might change all that? Shouldn't we be most careful not to do anything which might lead to a professional or proprietary class within your ranks?"
Wow.
These were great words for Alcoholics Anonymous. We alcoholics admitted their weight. Disappointed that our hope of substantial money help seemed to be fading, we confessed nevertheless that we had often had such misgivings. But we persisted, what are we going to do? It has taken us 3 years to form three groups. We know we have a new life for those who die or go mad by thousands each year. Must our story wait while it is passed around by word of mouth only, becoming hopelessly garbled meanwhile? Finally, our friends agreed that something needed to be done, but they did continue to insist our movement ought never be professionalized. This struck the keynote of our relation to these men of goodwill for all the years since. Rightly enough, they have never secured us large sums of money, and they didn't.
Right.
But each has given of himself our cause, generously and continuously. How much, few AAs can never know. I say he's really given this group of people that revolved around the Rockefeller Foundation a lot of props, mm-hmm. and maybe they were really helpful with their advice and everything, but the money really never came. I think there was $5,000, an initial $5,000, and Dr. Bob got most of that to pay off his house or something. I mean, there wasn't a lot of money. Seeing clearly that we must now spread the recovery message faster, they then suggested we might carefully experiment with a small rest home at Akron. This could be presided over by Dr. Bob, who was, after all, a physician. Whereupon, early in 1938, Frank Amos, on his own time and with expenses paid by his associates, went to Akron to investigate. He returned most enthusiastic. He was inclined to the opinion that $30,000 ought to be invested in a center for alcoholics. Our friend Dick Richardson showed Frank's report to Mr. John D. Rockefeller Jr., who at once manifested a warm interest. But Mr. Rockefeller also expressed anxiety about professionalizing us. Nevertheless, he gave us a sum, which it turned out to be, however, about 1/6 of the amount Frank had suggested. His gift came in the spring of 1938, and its result was to help Dr. Bob and me get through a very trying year. We could not have actually continued without it. Yet money-wise, our budding movement of alcoholics was still left very much on its own. Just where it should have been left to, however difficult that seemed at the time. We still had no field staff, no hospital, and no book. More and more when I really dig into the history, Monty, it's amazing how many disappointments and how many brick walls they ran into. Mm. Bill wasn't able to get one person sober for his first 6 months. I mean, it took him 3 years to get three small groups. You go on and on. They kept trying this and they kept trying that. And they kept trying to organize this. And there were so many disappointments. But if you look back at it, those were the perfect disappointments for this to become what it is today. Don't you think so?
Yeah, I do. And when you're in the middle of the storm, when you're in the middle of the disappointment, you don't look at it that way, right? But when you look back, I mean, if Bill's up there sitting with the great master right now listening to this show, who knows? He might be going, man, I am glad we went through what we went through. I know in my personal story, there was a lot of what I would consider failures back then, but were really successes. I see them as successes today. And I think that speaks to the statement, we do not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it.
Yeah, I think so too. When I look at my life in perspective, there was horrible years in my life with horrible situations. and broken, sweet relationships were dead. You know, I mean, you know, I could go on and on and on. But I've got to tell you, every single one of those built up in me a place that caused a surrender to start living along spiritual lines. And it's living along spiritual lines that has brought me the value I have today in my life. Now, I wouldn't have just decided on a Thursday, I think I'll start living along spiritual lines. I wasn't that kind of person. I needed to have the walls close in around me and not to be, you know, placed before me as quite possibly the only option for me to start to do that, because I didn't think it would work, Monty. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't think it would work. I get all that spiritual stuff. I get that stuff. I get God and I get Christianity and I get all that. You know, I don't need it, when that's just not true. Once I experienced all of that, it's all I need.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
There were the events that led to the formation of the Alcoholic Foundation. The need for a volume describing our recovery experiences loomed larger than ever. Were such a book to appear, a great flow of inquiries from alcoholics and their families might start. Thousands, maybe. These appeals would certainly have to be cleared through some sort of central office. That was most evident. For these saner purposes, our friends suggested the formation of a foundation to which givers might make tax-free contributions. We alcoholics endlessly discussed this new project with them, consuming hours of their business time. Frank Amos and a friendly attorney, John E.F. Wood, put much effort on the original foundation trust agreement. The lawyer had never seen anything like it. The new foundation should, we insisted, have two classes of trustees, alcoholics and non-alcoholics. But legally speaking, what was an alcoholic anyhow, he queried. And if an alcoholic had stopped drinking, was he an alcoholic anymore? Then why two classes of trustees? That, said our attorney, was unheard of. We explained that we wanted our friends with us. And besides, we urged, suppose all of us alcoholics should get drunk at once. Who then would hang on to the money? Surmounting many such obstacles, the Alcoholic Foundation was finally inaugurated. It had four non-alcoholic and three alcoholic trustees. They could appoint their own successors. It was chartered to do everything under the sun, so it had everything except money. Now, here's an interesting thing, Monty. So there's a ton of unwritten history. You know, like there can be like a dark side or a controversial side of things that went on. And for the most part, when Bill wrote, you know, he wrote about the positive stuff, right? But four non-alcoholic trustees and three alcoholic trustees. What happened over the years was Bill started to see that these non-alcoholics didn't get it. First of all, they were all in New York. They didn't get around the country. They didn't know what the people in Oregon were doing with AA. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there was three alcoholic trustees. So Bill concluded that it would be very, very important for there to be a majority alcoholic trustees. The majority must be alcoholic. And pushing that, what I've heard is the Rockefellers, the non-alcoholic trustees, we're talking the late 40s, the early 50s, were really reluctant to do that. I mean, once they had their seat at the board table,
yeah,
you know, trying to take it away was not going to be easy. And you've heard of AA Comes of Age, right?
Yes.
You've heard that at one of the world conferences, Bill gave AA to itself, right?
Yeah.
You've heard about, you know, I think it was the 1950 or 1955 World Convention where Bill stepped back He completely stepped back, and he said it's time for this organization to move forward on its own, and, you know, without me meddling in it. Now, what I've heard was the deal he had to make with the non-alcoholic trustees was just that. He had to step away.
Oh, wow.
And they would agree to the change. They would agree to the change of majority alcoholic trustees. And, you know, it's really hard to find this information. I got this information from someone who was a trustee, and he, you know, he really had gone through every bit of archive that you can go through. He was really well respected in the General Service Organization, and that's the story he told me. So it was a sacrifice. You know, Bill Wilson turns Alcoholics Anonymous over basically to itself, you know, without him, being able to exert his influence as a founder, for Alcoholics Anonymous to grow up and become a majority alcoholic board of directors. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Do you think that Bill had any clue, though, that his influence would remain long after his death? Do you think he had any idea?
You know, there's a funny quote of his. He got, after he had stepped away from, you know, the day to day, every single minute detail of Alcoholics Anonymous, he started to get involved in some other things. And one of them was a vitamin therapy. Vitamin B12 or something. I can't remember, but he got really serious into that, and he believed that was going to really benefit alcoholics, and, you know, worked with some medical people and some universities. And he said one time that he's not going to be remembered for what he did for Alcoholics Anonymous. He's going to be remembered for what he did for vitamin B12 therapy.
Really?
He really thought that, right? So, yeah, so you know, that's another one of those quotes that comes from who knows where, but I trust it, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, how do you know? How do you know? But he died in, what, 1971? That was a long time ago. 1971 was over 50 years ago he died. So what he knew was, he knew what Alcoholics Anonymous was from 1940 to 1971. He had 31 years of it, and he saw it grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. Was he aware of just how much credit he was going to get in the future for starting one of the most powerful spiritual movements of the last 500 years? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but he is. He was the principal architect of one of the most significant spiritual movements in history. You know, listen, there was the Enlightenment. There was like three Enlightenments, right, Monty? You know, where the 10th revivals in the 1800s, right, and stuff, where wholesale communities were brought to Christ. So there were a lot of movements. But when you think about how many people Alcoholics Anonymous impacted, millions and millions and millions, and how many people outside of that the 12-step program of recovery has impacted, more millions, you know, it was a significant thing.
You bet.
It was an absolute significant thing.
Well, I'll tell you, and I want the listeners to know this. So I got an email the other day, where can I get a copy of this book? Well, I got mine off Amazon. And you can do that. We're going to put up a link on the page, the dedicated webpage for Walking Through the Language of the Heart, on that page, to where you can just click on it and go straight to Amazon and pick up a copy of the book. Fascinating stuff. every time we read an article, I'm blown away by the information. I said last week that I hadn't read this in a long time, and I didn't remember most of it, but I don't think I remember any of it, just like you. I don't remember reading this article. I really don't. Maybe I just wasn't paying attention, or I'd, you know, sat in the meeting or something where they passed it around. I don't remember. I know I had a copy of this. I couldn't tell you where it was. This one is, you know, one I purchased here several weeks ago before we started doing the show. Well, Chris, thank you again for walking us through this. Next week, what do we have? Last 7 years have made AA self-supporting. That'll be interesting. And that was
a little bit more in the money.
A little bit more in the money, right. The whole idea of being self-supporting. I will tell you that when it comes to that tradition that where we refer to being self-supporting, that has actually benefited me in my personal life more than I can tell you. It really has. And that's one of the wonderful gifts about you know, the 12 and 12, for instance. You can take some of these things and apply these principles into your own personal life. You don't have to be an alcoholic to benefit from it. It's just great material, right?
Absolutely. Being self-supporting through your own contributions is a spiritual principle.
Yeah.
And if I'm working with somebody, I'm going to encourage that. Every once in a while, you get somebody who, you know, who comes in, he's getting sober, he's on temporary disability and unemployment and living at mom's, you know, yeah. and pretty quickly, I start to encourage self-supporting through their own contributions, because, you know, these spiritual principles, they're not punishment.
No.
What they are is their best practices for living, for being a human being.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they are.
They're great. All right, folks, don't forget you can catch up on all these episodes by visiting us at take12radio.com and clicking on the Recovery Workshops banner. And if you didn't catch that, at the very end, the closing piece says it again, too. Email us at take12radio@comcast.net with your remarks and your comments. Love us, hate us, we don't care. We want to hear from you, though. So we encourage that. All right, Chris, thank you so much, my friend. Until our next broadcast, this is the Monty Man along with Chris S., and we are wishing God's perfect serenity for you. For more recovery workshops with Chris S. and the Monty Man, visit our website at take12radio.com and click on the Recovery Workshops banner.
This has been a broadcast of Take 12 Recovery Radio and KHLT Recovery Broadcasting.
Kitty, meow, meow, meow.